As a professor at Yale, Professor Bill Derezowitz saw something that troubled him deeply. His students, some of the nation's brightest minds, were adrift when it came to the big questions: how to think critically and creatively, and how to find a sense of purpose. His new book, Excellent Sheep, takes a sharp look at the high-pressure conveyor belt that begins with parents and counselors who demand perfect grades and culminates in the skewed applications that Derezowitz saw firsthand as a member of Yale's admissions committee. We welcome William Derezowitz to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
The title of the book, Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. At what point did you come to where you decided that you had to share this and broaden your thoughts and share it with a larger audience?
Well, this was really a book that came to me more than the other way around. I wrote an essay about these things 6 years ago called The Disadvantages of an Elite Education. I called it that because the advantages are so obvious and everybody sort of recognizes what they are, but there wasn't really a sense that there was something that was being given up by these kids. And I published this thing 6 years ago, small journal, and it went viral immediately. And I started to hear from hundreds of kids. And at this point, I visited over a dozen campuses and heard from hundreds of more kids. And that's, you know, that's when I realized that this needed to be a book, because students really want to talk about this. They want to talk about the things that there's no room in their education as it currently exists to talk about, like what, in a bigger sense, is my education for? How can I think about what I want to do with my life in a way that goes beyond just jumping through the next hoop, which is what I've been trained to do my whole life?
In your answer, you are saying that it is the students who are seeking the information, and in the book you put a lot of at least a portion of the blame on parents who you feel are ultimately failing their children by putting them through this high pressure loop to get into these elite schools.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I want to be clear. While I'm critical of the students in the sense of sort of diagnosing where I think things have gone wrong for them, I certainly don't blame them for their situation. And I do blame, well, adults in general. I mean, I don't think that colleges are distinguishing themselves in this respect either. I think prep schools and affluent private public high schools don't seem to be doing a very good job as well. But yes, ultimately this is up to the parents. And, you know, at the high school level, a lot of this has been well documented. There are books, there are articles about the kind of pressure these kids are under and the mental health consequences. I mean, affluent kids are among the least happy kids in the country if you go by, you know, just simple mental health statistics, depression, anxiety. That continues into college, and it continues for the exact same reason. Parents, I think, sometimes for understandable but misguided reasons, sometimes for less admirable reasons, like status competition in affluent communities, are putting kids under a level of stress that no kid should have to endure.
So how does it become a miseducation?
Well, it's a miseducation partly for the reasons I've already said, that education becomes, as one student said to me, like a video game. It's just something that you need to crack to get to the next level. These kids are very sort of competent in the sense of always being able to get the A, but that doesn't mean they're learning a lot.
Right.
And it certainly doesn't mean that they're developing a real independence of mind or real intellectual curiosity, as opposed to, what do I need to do to ace the next test?
But which is harder to prove, isn't it?
Well, you know, I know that the book has been criticized for some people for lack of statistical evidence. I present a lot of statistics where statistics are possible, like mental health statistics,
right?
In some, there's some things that you can't measure, right? And that you can only hear from people, listen to their stories. I've been listening to what students have been telling me, and I have to say, not a lot of other people are. not a lot of people have. Many people who've written against this book, they really have no evidence whatsoever. They've never talked to anyone about this. But when I talk to other people who've talked to kids, like high school teachers who are conscientious, professors, other people at colleges, parents who become aware, sometimes kind of late in their kids' life, what's going on, they absolutely see what I see.
I guess, and you make the point in the book, and I guess what I'm driving at is how the situation is different. I mean, because there is an overall rap on higher education and even education in general that, you know, you're teaching to the test and they get the A and then they move on and they haven't actually retained this knowledge. You do talk in the book about, you know, that a liberal arts education with looking at the humanities and in small classrooms by dedicated teachers is something that ultimately is kind of the perfect environment, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yes, I mean, I'm not sure I'd use the word perfect, but yes, I mean, that to me is
a more suitable
education should be. A liberal arts education conducted in small classrooms, which is what I think the best schools do. And by the best schools, I don't mean Harvard and Yale.
Right.
Yeah.
And why are they not allowed, do you think, not allowed, but why do you think that is not their, because once you send the students there, once there is the pressure on them and there is this conveyor belt, as you call it, once you send it to these places of higher learning, then it is up to them to in a perfect world correct that situation and to make it positive for the students. So what burden what level of blame do you have on the institution themselves?
Well, I mean, I think the institutions are not paying attention to this at all. They, you know, everything seems fine to them. They're financially very healthy, unlike many other colleges and universities. The most prestigious ones are doing great. The people who work there make a lot of money. They retain their high rankings, which is what everybody seems to pay attention to. They are celebrated institutions. Their students, you know, their students do all the kinds of things that their schools can brag about. Whether that means that they're paying attention to the actual quality of undergraduate education is a completely different story. I mean, I think that's why they're not. And again, I'm not the first person to write about this in that respect. A former dean of Harvard College, Harry Lewis, wrote a book in which he said, a former dean of Harvard College said, Harvard no longer knows what a good education is. I mean, these are, let's not forget, these are primarily research institutions, and they're terrific research institutions, but what that means is that that's what they care about, and when it comes to their professors, that's how they reward them. Professors have no incentive, and often explicit disincentives, from spending one second more than they need to on their teaching with their students.
So you're...
Nobody seems to know this outside of the profession, but everybody in the profession is perfectly aware of this fact.
So as I mentioned in the introduction, you were a member of the Yale Admissions Committee. So you saw this. So how do you, is it something that is just accepted or within the system, is it something that you react to and say, okay, well, this is how we have to do it, or is there dissension in the ranks as it's happening?
Well, let me say a couple of things. I don't claim to know what's going on because I was a member of the admissions committee. As a professor, I was only there for one day. What I did see on that day confirmed everything I'd been seeing for 10 years as a professor, which is the kinds of students the system, the admission system produces. I mean, and after all, it's the admission system that's the key here, because
right,
it's the admission system that determines, in some sense, every day of an adolescent's life in these communities, in these families that are aiming their kids at the Ivy League. So, you know, admissions does what admissions does. I think these admissions officers are very well-intentioned, and they're working within the guidelines that they've received from on high. What we were talking about before wasn't a matter so much of admissions as of the quality of the education once kids get to those schools. And that is something that's, you know, that's not admissions business. It's hard to say whose business it is, really, is the problem. Every professor has his or her own field of research. The courses they teach they teach whatever they want, generally speaking. There's very little coordination. Sometimes within a department, you know, within a history department, you know, they'll try to, you know, have an array of offerings, but there's no real, nobody's really thinking in the big picture about the undergraduate educational experience, and even those who are really have no power to change it. So really, it's just been kind of drifting along under sort of its own momentum for reasons that have very little to do with what would make for a good education for students. I argue that places like liberal arts colleges, and that also includes the honors colleges at public universities, they do things differently. They make an effort to think about, in the big picture, what does a kid need to learn in college?
And it seems in reading the book that you make the case that much of this is cultural, not as educational as it is cultural. That there is a sense of inequality that comes in at the very beginning, that it's only exacerbated, that there is a perpetuating of privilege among the student body, and there's very much a difference, of saying, okay, you're elite, and putting a culture and placing these students in a culture that says it's sort of us versus them, and now you go lead them.
Yeah. I mean, when we say that it's cultural, I don't want to excuse the individual actors within this system, all of whom I think have responsibilities, and in most cases are failing those responsibilities, including the students' own responsibility to kind of take control of their education. And I want to say that half of the book is not critique. That's the first half. But the second half is a constructive, positive message for kids about how they can think about their education differently and help, as the subtitle says, find their way to a meaningful life. But the things that you're talking about are sort of the bigger social, socioeconomic picture, which is that this system, and this is certainly statistically verifiable, perpetuates inequality. It's supposed to mitigate inequality, and 50 years ago it did, but because it takes so much money to produce sort of an admissions-ready kid, what you end up with is increasingly affluent families winning the contest. And so you have young people who, first of all, they sort of grow up in a sort of in homogenous affluent communities and never meet anybody else. And second of all, as a Harvard student said, they're force-fed more praise than they know what to do with from, you know, the moment they start school. You're the best and the brightest, right? That's the phrase that
right.
was used. So what we've ended up with, and this is how I conclude the book, we've ended up over the last several decades that this system has been in place, because this is not just about today's kids or millennials, we've ended up with an adult leadership class that has these exact characteristics. They are both out of touch and extremely full of themselves. You know, they're very self-serving. They may not realize it, but basically this is all about them. But they feel themselves to be these tremendously virtuous, best and brightest, you are going to lead the world, you are going to save the world. They're not saving the world. I think we've seen over the last 10 years what they're doing, which is driving it off a cliff.
As you mentioned, much of the book is prescriptive. So in the few moments that we have left, what do you believe are the key ingredients that are needed to reform and to replace the system?
Well, my most important recommendation is not about reforming the admissions process, although that would certainly help. I think we need to step even farther back and say the real problem here is that we've outsourced the training of our leadership class to a set of private institutions who will always be acting from their own interests and will always be creatures of the rich, if only because they have to be. And so what we really need to do is to recommit ourselves to what we committed ourselves originally in the years after World War II, which is top quality, low cost, public higher education. We have systematically disinvested from public higher education over the last 30 years. We now spend about half of what we used to. We need to do something about that, and that means raising taxes on the top 10%, just like we need to reinvest in our physical infrastructure. We need to reinvest in our mental infrastructure, not just for the sake of the country as a whole, but also to restore equity to the system so that everybody really does have a fair shot at rising in society.
William Derezowitz's book is Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. Bill, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Great pleasure. Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.